You're listening to The Dirt on the Past, a show on history and archaeology and why it matters today. You can find us on the Extreme History Project website and also on kgbm.org. Thanks for listening. Welcome to The Dirt on the Past from the Extreme History Project and KGBM Community Radio.
Whether digging up a site or dusting off the archives, we bring you some of the most fascinating and cutting-edge research in history and archaeology, and discuss why it matters today. Join me, Nancy Mahoney, alongside co-host Crystal Alegria, as we converse with anthropologists, archaeologists,
and historians about how they bring the past alive.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's edition of the show. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And we are the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. This week we're at Extreme History Headquarters speaking in person, which is such a pleasure, with Dr. Jennifer Hill. We're excited to talk with Jennifer about her new book, Birthing the West, Mothers and Midwives in the Rockies and Plains. But before we get to that, Crystal, how was your week?
Well, it was really good. It's been a few weeks since we talked, so we've been
That's true.
A lot of things in relation to Women's History Month, which is March. And now we're just coming into April, which here in Montana is Archaeology Month. So two of my favorite months of the year.
Right.
We've done a lot of presentations on historic women in Montana. And I did a presentation on activists and advocates, which was really fun, from our local town of Bozeman. So I learned a lot about some of the local hellraisers. And it was wonderful. We also had an amazing event for you, Jennifer.
Yes.
We did a book signing event at Montana State University in conjunction with the MSU Doig Center and with the American Studies Department that you teach for. And so it was just a wonderful event, and we had so many people attend, and I just love listening to you talk about this book that we're going to talk more about today. So lots of great things have happened, and going forward into Archaeology Month, we will be talking on this podcast more about archaeology, but in general, talking more about Archaeology Month in Montana this month, which is
exciting.
Super exciting.
Yeah.
So Nancy, what about you?
Well, last weekend, I was in Denver for the American Association of Biological Anthropologists. And though I am not a biological anthropologist, I went to graduate school with many of them. So I had a lot of old friends from graduate school, not that they are old, but that I have known them for a long time. And we had a big conference downtown, and I got to not only see people I hadn't seen in a while, but see a lot of their students presenting research either as an oral paper or posters. So my goal was to be introduced around as a co-host of The Dirt on the Past, which all of my friends were happy to do. And they introduced me to some folks who are doing some really fascinating research that involves biological anthropology and overlaps with either history or archaeology. So look forward to some of those wonderful podcasts, because we'll be calling on those folks who've been recently publishing some of their research. So that was exciting.
Yeah.
Yes, but I'm ready to turn our attention back to our guest. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me. I am so glad to be here.
And we're so glad you're here with us today, Jennifer, to talk about this amazing book.
Yes. So before we get to the book itself, Jennifer, we always start by introducing our guests to our listeners. So we want to start off by telling a little bit about you. Dr. Jennifer J. Hill is an assistant teaching professor of American Studies at Montana State University. She also serves as the executive director of the Women's Reproductive History Alliance, a digital museum dedicated to educating the public on reproductive history. She is passionate about interdisciplinary scholarship and bringing the untold and undocumented stories to the public.
So welcome, Jennifer. And we always like to start off by asking our guests what brought them to their fields of study. And what Nancy didn't say is that you also had an alternate career in accounting.
That is true.
So you,
which sometimes we like to tap into.
We do. We do. We have, sometimes I just know I have to talk to you about some accounting thing, and I'm so glad I have you to do that with. But before, you had this whole career as an accountant. What brought you to history? Why did you come? Why did you make the transition from accounting to the field of history and then to the field of reproductive history?
Well, it certainly wasn't for monetary reasons, but it was actually for larger reasons that have to do with meaning. So, you know, people always say that all of the creative accountants are the ones in jail, but that's part of the problem, is that, you know, you
not can, a lot of room for creativity.
No,
legal
no.
creativity. Gotcha.
Certainly not legal creativity, and also not creativity in the sense of discovering new ideas, talking about things that are really meaningful. You know, I mean, the best day as an accountant was when I could save someone money. Mm. But that's very different than talking about stories that haven't been told, about relationships that are significant, about human systems that impact all of us. And so I wanted to do something I cared about more. And I've been grateful for the opportunity.
Did your accounting career fund your return to school to get a higher education? Yeah.
No. Well, in the sense that as an accountant, I was the single parent of three kids. So in that situation, there's not a lot of extra to go around. So no, I wish I could tap back into the pay scale of an accountant during tax season.
Right.
But I certainly have no regrets about the nature of the work I do now, because it's so much more alive and creative and vibrant, even though it's very much in the past.
Well, we are so excited to have you in the field. And I learned a lot about teaching American studies from you when I was delving into my return to school also. So your book, Birthing the West, really delves into the history of the Northwestern Plains and Rockies region. But it's from a perspective that has really been left out of so many histories of the West and settling the West. So you focus on, rather than the extractive economies that we're so much more familiar with in terms of mining, logging, harvesting game, and all of that, you focus rather on what you call these productive, reproductive, creative economies. And that really takes you into the realm of women's labor. And I mean that in both senses of the word, women coming out here to create families, laboring to give birth, raising children, and then all of the women's work around also, you know, raising chickens, the livestock, and the turning that into the food and the nourishment and the communities and those relationships. So I just think this was a fascinating focus on the West, and I think what your book does is make a really amazing case for how this is such an important aspect of what's been left out. So you focus on the mid-1800s through the 1940s in
Correct.
The Dakotas and Wyoming and Montana, and you have reproduction as the center of your story, sort of from the outside, making the case that it's, you know, the very basis of what you need to have any sort of community anywhere. But there's not a lot of written history that focuses on reproduction, especially in the historic West and this sort of Northwestern
Absolutely.
Region. So birth and the processes of birth, women in the past, not a lot of documentation always, especially in the earlier period. So tell us a little bit about how you came onto this topic, how you decided to tackle it and turn it into a book, because often when we know there's a gap in the historical record, it's often because it's hard to get at that information.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, so both those things, how you came to the topic and then how you decided that you would find a way
that
to tackle
it. Anything
yeah.
about it. In terms of how I came to it, we always come, or I would say the most interesting histories are those that we have personal motivation or some sort of deep connection to. And this was a topic that had always interested me, and especially, I mean, if you have an inquiring mind, anything that's sort of off limits is that much more interesting. And so topics of sex and contraception, yes, and
the personal
abortion and reproduction and who was born and where and where did you come from, all of those kinds of questions were always, you know, they're sort of taboo, yeah, in American culture. And so I always wanted to know more, not less, about those. And then in my academic research, realizing that those areas, not only were they not something that people talked about in everyday conversation as much as they might, but it also was a subject of silence in academic conversation. And the more I put my feelers out and discovered that it wasn't that there weren't things to say about this topic, but that in fact there was rich information. I mean, I always say to all people, one of the few things we all have in common is that we were all born, and we all get here via reproduction. So it's something that's a universal that we all share. And inevitably, it's interesting. Frankly, I think it's way more interesting than...
Right. We all birth, but how we birth, what we say about it, what it means, but also the physical aspects,
yes,
of at which. So how did you find, when did you first know that you could find information to tackle the topic?
Well, I it took me a long time to think I could find enough information to say anything generalizable or about the region as a whole. That took a while. So what I was doing is just in other researching forays and prepping classes and doing public lectures on other topics having to do with the American West, I tried to give time to reproductive space and to make sure that I collected those stories when I came across them. And then, you know, after a couple of years, the number of those stories added up, and I realized, oh, this is more than just a few anecdotes. There's actually a real history here. And the other thing that I discovered was that in this part of the country, given the way the timing worked out, that women's reproductive history was actually recorded in the 1970s and 1980s with the big push for oral history. So a lot of oral historians, a lot of them state historical societies, were trying to record the stories of quote-unquote pioneers,
right,
of white people who came to the area and settled before they all died. And none of those questions were oriented around reproduction, or none of those interviews were specifically to record the details of reproduction. But reproduction mattered to these people, and so they volunteered information about it. They said things about it. And so realizing that the process of listening to women actually had a tremendous amount to offer, that there were stories if you could find them in the right place, and enough stories to actually make a book, to say something, not just to talk about, I mean, great Aunt Mabel and what is important, but you need to be able to have more than just scattered anecdotes to be able to say something substantive. Mm.
So how did you go about doing this? So there's these oral histories out there. You've
right.
defined that there's oral histories. There's some passages and documents. What was your process? How did you go about finding this information, kind of gleaning it from all these bits and pieces in all these different oral histories and documents?
Well, I mean, at a certain point when I realized that almost every state had some repository of oral histories, then it became the logical next step. Well, go listen to all those oral histories.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
How do you listen to all those oral histories? No,
yeah.
There's always a lot, and they're usually 2 or 3 hours long each.
Absolutely. And I talk about in the book the fact that rarely were they indexed. So it's not like you can walk into an archive and say, I'd like everything you have about the process of childbirth, please. They just aren't indexed that way. And so these are passing comments that people make. Maybe they elaborate a little bit. But yeah, it was a lot of legwork and a lot of hours listening to tapes. Fortunately, some institutions will loan those out, so I didn't have to go to every single institution. But yeah, there was a lot of driving.
Can you tell us that's the story about going to North Dakota?
Yes, absolutely. It's in the North Dakota story.
Yeah.
Because North Dakota, like a lot of other archival institutions, had a stash of oral histories. And those oral histories I knew that they had them, and so I made a trip. We had planned this, you know, research dollars are in short supply, et cetera, et cetera. So I budgeted out for this trip, and we were going to hit as many possible research institutions on the way as possible. And I, at this time, two of my daughters were young and at home. I think they were maybe 13 and 9 at the time. And so we had, you know, we were going from research institution to research institution. And if you're 13 or 9, you know that this is the height of excitement to go with your mother across the West from archival institution to archival institution. But that was the plan. So there were a few moments of bribery included, like reptile gardens and, you know, when we went through South Dakota.
Yeah.
But so, you know, at every other institution, the same thing occurred in North Dakota is I started listening. I asked, okay, can I see this archival collection that you have, all of these oral histories, and in North Dakota, only to come to understand that there was literally no index and no transcript. So all of these oral histories, we had no idea what topics were even covered, etc. So one of my daughters was very avidly coloring. That was her job for the trip. And the other one actually was incredibly helpful. And so she and I both started listening. And we discovered that one of the interviewers, so usually when archives or historical societies did oral history projects, they would get a group of oral historians who would then get into the routine. They'd figure out what people they wanted to interview. And one of these interviewees, his name was Larry Sprunk, and he did a great job of listening. He actually, instead of going through this rote list of questions for these quote-unquote old-timers, he would actually listen to what they said that was important about their lives, and then he would ask follow-up questions depending on what they were talking about. And he was also very open to asking follow-up questions about birth and reproduction, which was unusual. A lot of times, oral history interviewers would try to direct the conversation elsewhere when those topics came up. And, you know, so when did you file your homesteading claim, as opposed to why did you keep having babies, you know, which would have been...
Thank goodness for Larry.
Yeah, I know, I know. So I still have to find out where Larry is or anything. But yes, I owe Larry a dinner or something.
Yes.
a great debt of gratitude. So then we, you know, we kind of buzzed through, stopping and starting to listen to as many of those as possible. And then we made sure that we listened to all of Larry's interviews because there was more opportunity, especially for women, to talk about their birthing experiences with him. So it, you know, there may be another book's worth of experiences out there because these items aren't cataloged or identified clearly in archives. I don't know that I got literally everything. By the time I had been through such a massive amount of information over a number of year period and began to hear, you know, yet another rendition of the same story. After enough layers of that, it builds confidence that, okay, yes, there's this material supports some of the conclusions that I've come to. But I have no doubt that there are more wonderful stories. And in fact, at that event that you mentioned, Crystal, the book event, I actually had someone come up to me and tell me yet another story about their grandmother who had been a midwife, and that story has been recorded by no one at this point, and it fit right in with a lot of the other stories that I had heard.
People have been telling me about their midwife stories that I still need to pass on to you.
You're collecting them.
So,
yeah.
after doing that book signing, I've had a few people email and say, you should tell Jennifer that my grandmother was a midwife in Virginia City. And
I know. Anymore I say, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
You know, that's wonderful. They were everywhere.
Yeah.
This was the norm. This was not unusual.
Yeah.
When you first started writing this book and we were reading some of the earlier drafts of the chapters and coming to understand what research you are uncovering, I remember very much thinking, I was also steeped in some research about sort of the period of 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s on my own work about archaeology, but I was thinking about the particular man that I was researching at the time who had come out as a young man and made a homesteading claim, staked his claim, proved up, and then married a much younger woman from the neighboring ranch family. And of course, the first thing they live in is a dugout house. And you have that amazing photograph in the book. And over and over again, when we would be engaging with you and sharing things to read, putting myself in the place of these women, not only the ones that maybe had grown up out here, but more likely in so many cases had moved out.
Correct.
To the Dakotas or Montana or Wyoming to maybe even come out with the purposes of meeting their husband who had gone ahead or come out to get married. They had left so much of their family relations behind, their sisters, their mother, and then all of a sudden you're entering into marriage in this home, if you can even call it that, dug into the earth. You know, cows are walking on the roof, and you're in this crazy prairie area, and you start your marital life, and you're going to get pregnant if things go the way they go. And the thought of birthing in those places, in those conditions, and so far from people. And it was fascinating to then learn what you were uncovering about how this happened, because all of a sudden it gave me a very different perspective of what that must have felt like as a young woman in those situations. So I want you to talk a little bit, if you can, about the range, because I feel like we have these young women who had family farther east, whether it was Midwest or even further east. And you say some stayed and were able to take advantage of a midwife who very often was somebody who was an immigrant from Europe, who had those skills, or they were someone who had the means to leave early enough on some sort of train or something to go back east to give birth. But what those experiences, the range of those experiences were like, you know, because some women really give birth and without consequence, and we know others, it often leads to maternal or infant death. So talk a little bit about that earlier period, sort of 1860s to 1880s and 90s, and what that was like for women.
Sure. Well, there are some consistent conditions. I mean, obviously, anytime you look at a region, the question would be, what is the same and what is different?
Right.
So for this region, what was different was their background and the assumptions that they came to reproduction with. Was this their first pregnancy? Was it their fifth pregnancy? You know, that would make a big difference in terms of your experience. What they all dealt with was the landscape, was the geography, and the fact that this was land in this region that I deal with in the book that did not support a lot of people in highly concentrated areas. So we have to recognize there are a few urban areas, and practicing as midwives in those urban areas was different than practicing as midwives in rural areas, as was delivering a baby. Going through the process of labor and delivery in those urban areas was very different because you had more access to more people. As we look at those more sparsely settled areas, the thing that was consistent was the challenge of finding someone else to be with you during that time. And that was something that we don't necessarily give full credit to from our modern perspective. So this was a time of social birth, if I can introduce that concept now.
Yeah.
The sense that if you were going to go into labor, you thought of it as a time when those females who were near and dear to you, and maybe not so near and dear, but showed up anyways, would gather round. So it was a social time. It was not something that was seen as a medical event in 1860. That was not the first thought in people's minds was, call the doctor. Not by any means. It was, oh, well, get my female close associates and whoever is the designated expert who's going to direct the action, and let's all get together, and we'll spend the next couple days together, usually. Sometimes it was shorter than that. And so when you think about if that's the context you come from, you've grown up, let's say, if you're a young woman heading out to the either Montana, the Dakotas, or Wyoming, and you've grown up attending births as a teenager, even as a 12 or 13-year-old, all the way up through your own reproductive years, you would be thinking about getting together with other people. And then all of a sudden, you're out on a homestead in Montana or the Dakotas or Wyoming, and just having anyone show up is a challenge because you're so separated.
I mean, you can be many miles away, but also as you talk about the landscape and the weather could really increase the difficulty in anyone being able to attend.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you're talking about, you know, different times of the year, it's more predictable or less predictable, but roads becoming impassable, all of those sorts of constraints made it really challenging. So that was one of the things that women talked about so consistently, was their concern that they not be alone. They weren't particularly concerned about having a, you know, as we would be now, a particular piece of equipment at the ready. Right. That was not the concern. It was, is there another woman who can be with me? And what's not necessarily understood when we say, is there another woman, is this another woman implies at that time a particular level of expertise. Mm-hmm. Because if you were part of this world of social birth as a woman, you actually knew a lot about birth, even if you were not one of the immigrant women who had come from a country that actually had formal midwifery training. So even if you lacked formal midwifery training, you had seen a long list of births, and you had a tremendous amount of knowledge about what to expect, how to help, how to support the process. And so that was what women were looking for, was can there be someone else who can support me as a woman who also happens to be an expert in this process?
And it seems you talked a lot about not just in understanding what's going to happen during the birthing process and how to support that, especially given the range of things that might happen.
Right.
You've seen a number of births. You've seen enough of those different possible outcomes that you might need to assist with. But also you talk about, especially if the woman already has some other children.
Correct.
But if she's on a ranch, which so many people were during this time, the amount of labor that they were involved in on a daily basis with cooking, cleaning, making food, you know, all of that, there's still kids to mind. You needed somebody else while you were laboring and recovering to be able to do those things for you. I mean, you talked about how neighbors would come and sometimes plan to stay for a while and do the cooking and the cleaning, and then they would have some older child at home or somebody else. But there's so much about that social birth aspect.
Absolutely.
That was essential for survival of the mother. And it seems like in some ways it may have been reciprocal, not always monetary, but there was that exchange of resources, it
yes.
seems like.
Oh, yeah, and it was necessary for physical survival, but also economic survival.
Yeah.
Because when you're looking at the homesteading era, that labor that woman produced was so necessary to that family eating,
yes.
To being able to plant and harvest crops, to be able to sell things like butter and eggs, which actually bought a huge amount of farm equipment and paid for the team. And
I remember you
like
calculating out from journals where somebody who had so carefully, meticulously
yes.
documented, which some women did in their journals, you know, how many chicks were hatched and then, and wouldn't they exchange sometimes laying hens or other ones?
Oh, absolutely.
Because you needed to raise them, and then because some you wanted eggs, then you wanted some chickens, and then you're going to sell some, but then you're making butter and you're doing all these other things and you have to move it around at a certain time and get it to market or not. And it's an incredible amount of expertise and labor. But as you said, those were things people would pay cash for. They needed those things to live. And that's a lot of women's labor and, you know, contribution to the economy that doesn't get documented accounted for.
It doesn't get documented either financially, but it also doesn't get documented in terms of the establishment of culture and relationships and communities. Because as I'm thinking, I think you're probably referring to the diary of Lizzie McLean.
That's
and she,
right.
She was so meticulous, and it was, her records were wonderfully useful in terms of being able to establish how many different directions goods and services were going and how often those were gifted, were part of relationship building endeavors, and how often they were monetized, where there was actually money changing hands. And so there was not necessarily a clear pattern. There was a clear pattern for the people on the ground, because they were the ones building community. They were the ones establishing these relationships. But any particular service, butter could be gifted, but butter also had a clear set price. Birthing expertise and attendance could be gifted, but it also was often paid for. So those were the kinds of give and take relationships that helped, as I claim, birth the West, that made it a relational network that ended up being real communities where people could function within the systems that they had. And reproduction was a critical part of that. Absolutely.
Well, people being raised in the West, as you say in the book, I mean, before you had colonial men mainly coming out to mine, to hunt bison, to have some endeavor and then go back to families. You had indigenous families that were birthing here, but you didn't have a establishment of you know, a settlement community from Euro-American settlers.
Correct.
Unless you had women who were settled here and birthing and raising, because you couldn't be from Montana until there were people.
Until you could be right. born here.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, so it's just such a fascinating point you make that sounds so simple, but I think has so often been overlooked. It's so essential to what it took to settle and form a community mm-hmm. and a state, you
yes.
know, and part of our nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And just going back to this idea of social birth a little bit, Jennifer, because we had the opportunity to read a lot of these chapters before you published.
In process.
Yeah, in process. And we had many beers over these chapters.
Many beers and discussions.
And lots of French fries. We ate a lot of beer and French fries. Drank a lot of beer, ate a lot of French fries. And as we were talking through some of this, you know, this idea of social birth and this idea of community and that community birth, and talking about how these women would get together and, you know, if Lucy down the lane was about to give birth, you know, the family would up and go, the mom and maybe the two daughters who were 9 and 13 would go with her, and they would all be at this birth. And so these women, like you say, just saw this happen again and again and again, all these different circumstances. But as we were drinking our beers and eating our French fries, we're like, wait a minute, we did not do this. The first birth I saw was my own, when I had my daughter Emily. I mean, that was the first
right.
birth. No, I take that back. When I was in my birthing classes, I saw a video of a birth, but that
right,
was
but the first live
that was,
birth.
That was
exactly.
the first birth I saw. The first live birth was
I didn't
my
even
own
see
birth.
An animal birth.
Yeah,
until, like no, much
I
less a human
either.
Birth.
Which
yeah.
actually
yeah.
is a critical point to
That's
note because if you're coming from an agricultural background, you have the mammalian birth process
right.
is not that different. I mean, as much as we want to think of ourselves as different than cows and pigs and horses. It's the same process. It's, you know, the
right,
water
there's a
breaks,
lot of that, yep.
the, you know, the young one is born, the placenta is expelled afterwards. And so if you become really familiar with how to help your pig give birth, you actually can take a lot of that information and then apply it to a human delivery.
Right.
Yeah. yeah.
But it sounds like it was very much a women's domain.
Absolutely.
Too, which I
yeah.
think is fascinating. A lot of times men were just not really welcome, but women had the authority and the control. But we definitely had so many of these funny discussions where we thought it was kind of terrifying. You were so excited to get pregnant, you know, when you get married, and then you're like, oh,
yeah, now what?
Crap.
What happens?
I have no
yeah.
idea how this actually happens. And, you know, you almost then want to see or read everything you can about it, mm-hmm. but you feel woefully unprepared. And then also for everything that comes after nursing
right,
a child
right,
and everything.
Right.
But
and these women would stay with the woman who'd just given birth for a week or more
least.
After, right?
Yes.
To help with those chores that you were mm-hmm. talking about,
exactly.
Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
The cows aren't going to milk themselves, so
no.
someone has to milk
and
those cows.
And how reassuring
yeah.
if you knew you
yeah.
had somebody who was able to come and be with you.
Yeah.
Again, it's such a different process, and some people today are fortunate to have family that
yeah.
might be able to, but it's really so much happening out of the home, in mm-hmm. the hospital, not social, not with people
right.
you know.
Very isolating.
Very
yeah,
isolating.
Actually.
And so many women
yeah.
say even the person who's been their OB might not be the person who's on or scheduled,
right.
and so they don't even have a doctor
that
they know,
with,
that
right.
they're familiar with. I, being terrified of hospitals and injections, chose to have a midwife. We were living in New Mexico at the time in Albuquerque, and that was a state that still supported a lot of midwifery, and you could have a home birth or you could birth in the birthing center with a midwife. And my family was terrified for me, and no one knew what to expect. I enjoyed every single bit of the process because going to the midwife each month was this chance to sit down with this cup of herbal tea and have a whole conversation, and they'd check you in these certain ways, and it was just this whole education in motherhood and what was to come, and the way that they would support you for this long period in my own home, you know, up to the point in which I would birth and then after. And I really was grateful for that. I also knew there was a hospital down the road if I needed it, you know, and that these women, but it was, it was for me something that really I connected with when you started doing this research and thinking that would be something that would make me feel comfortable having that social birth or some midwife who could be with me. And I know for Crystal, you probably had a slightly different experience, but just putting yourself in the place of these women.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's a whole different notion of pioneering, you know?
Right. Yeah. In so many ways, you mentioned motherhood, though, that you got trained in motherhood, which is really fascinating to think about because we think of the pregnancy of or the process of labor and delivery as being, I mean, that's a biological or a physiological process. What it means to be a mother is a very different cultural process.
Yes. Point. Yes.
And it was very, and that was a very clear thing that these women were being taught also in the same way that you were being taught that. And that's one of the reasons why the whole process is so important, because there's this huge cultural meaning that gets imparted in discussions about these biological or physiological characteristics, processes, etc., that there's a whole lot more information about identity and meaning and your role and that comes with that.
And the solidification of community, too, you know, that and all of that. And so, you know, I think going back to our conversations over beer, you know, we were talking about birth a lot when we were discussing your chapters. And that was one of the first times I had talked about my own birth with a group of friends or colleagues, you know. And so we've even gotten away from even talking about it as women. So I thought that was fascinating.
And I felt, as we mentioned earlier, when you reminded me, it to me, that also generated a sense of closeness in sharing those birth stories. And that's one thing that the midwives in Albuquerque had us do. You could come every month to hear someone's birth story who had just given birth. And it did create a sense of demystifying it and closeness. But I was a junkie for reading people's birth stories after I gave birth. Yeah. But being able to share that, I think, with people is something I do wish there was much more openness in the culture. And it was such a pleasure being able to just watch this book evolve and come about and then just have it seep into our own personal way of engaging with this subject. I feel like I've brought it to my own discussions with my daughter and all of that. Yeah. We are just going to take a quick station break, and then Crystal will move on with the next question. You're listening to The Dirt on the Past with co-hosts Crystal Alegria and Nancy Mahoney on KGVM Bozeman or wherever you find your podcasts. Today we are speaking with Jennifer Hill about her new book, Birthing the West.
So Jennifer, I want to go down a different road now, and you know, I spent a lot of time, as people that listen to this podcast regularly know, in historic cemeteries. I love historic cemeteries. I love to wander through and see who the people are that are buried there. But unfortunately, it is often sad because there's so many children in our historic cemeteries. Tombstones bearing the names of children that lived a day, children that didn't that lived a few minutes. So there were incredible high rates of infant mortality in the 19th and 20th centuries here in the West, in Montana, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Idaho. And in fact, this area, and you talk about this in your book, is this area of Montana, the Dakotas, was called a death zone.
Correct.
So can you talk a little bit about this? And also, just kind of following up on what we just spoke to, that idea of community, how did these women help their family and their friends through losing a child?
Well, there's a whole bunch of questions right there. Yeah. So if I don't get to all of them,
that's
remind
okay.
me.
Yep.
First of all, let me put this in some context, because first of all, in terms of methodology or sources, at the same time as a lot of these women were experiencing these reproductive conditions, public health institutions were also being formed across the region in the early 1900s. And so before that, no one was collecting statistics. There was no way of knowing it was a death zone aside from knowing that that woman died and that baby died, examples like that. That wasn't entirely inaccurate. A lot of women knew how dangerous it was, but when institutions started collecting statistics, that's when it became very apparent how dire the situation was. So by the time we get to the 1917s, 1918s, etc., and Montana is releasing its vital statistics records, and it becomes apparent that this region is one of the most dangerous places to have a baby. And let me make sure that people understand that that's of places that were taking records. And so of those collecting areas, this one was one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous, and it was a death zone, that there were a number of conditions that caused that. And initially, a lot of people said, well, there's just not enough physicians in the area. And what my work does is it really pushes back on that and says, hold on, if we really look at why people were dying, it wasn't because of lack of care. Actually, midwives were doing a fabulous job of covering that. There were so few, hardly any women delivered alone. And so there was actually this infrastructure of care that women were providing for each other. But going back, Nancy, to some of the things that you were mentioning earlier, this was especially for rural women, an incredibly physically demanding environment to be in. And so women were depleted. They were exhausted. And exhaustion at that level is significant for anyone, no matter what your gender identity or biological identity. And so it wasn't as if men weren't experiencing this also, but they weren't trying to birth a baby at the same time. And that puts a tremendous strain on a system if you're not adequately supported. And so women who were exhausted were the ones that died. Babies that were birthed in a situation where there was not as much support were under more threat. And so it was those conditions that then generated these really high mortality rates. And we see this supported by people of the area. I always reference this physician in southeastern Montana who would not provide care for any woman who refused to come in and stay in town for several weeks prior to her delivery date, because he said, listen, you are all so worn out and exhausted, you're just going to die. You got to come into town. You got to come into town and rest up, and then I'll help you. But it's just futile to try and be doing this really exhausting, demanding process if you're not sleeping and eating and resting, and that you need to recuperate. This is just a really challenging, physically challenging lifestyle, and it resulted in a lot of death, unfortunately.
So tell us one story, though, that you talk about in the book about Lucy Tinsley, who kind of represents the opposite side of what
Absolutely.
You just told us, somebody who survived very many births and
yes.
went on to have a number of children. So tell us a little bit about her story.
Sure. Well, Lucy Tinsley is a wonderful example, actually, of a typical reproductive pattern for a woman of the time. So she moved out to Montana sort of post-Civil War and got married and then started having children, as in an age of scarce contraception was the norm. And she had a child about every 2 years, approximately. She ended up raising all 8 of her children to adulthood, which was really significant.
Remarkable.
So she did not lose any of them. And to relate this to what we were talking about with death and lack of support, her sister-in-law actually lived nearby, and from all evidence and account, it looks as if they were highly supportive of each other. So that her sister-in-law probably came and did all of that, not just domestic work, but agricultural work that women did at the time, so that Lucy Tinsley could recover from all of these pregnancies, so that she went into pregnancy not entirely depleted, and so that she could deliver a baby that was not as challenged as otherwise might have been, and could have the time to nurse and still recover, regain her strength, in part because she had a reliable support system.
All right. It just going back to that importance of community and the social aspects of birth, and probably to some extent where you were located and how easy it might have been for others to be in proximity to you or
True.
In an easier way to get there. Maybe she timed it so she always birthed in midsummer too. So
yeah, she could.
but there were women, of course, like or unlike Lucy Tinsley, who did not want to have children. And this often goes unmentioned since childbirth and child rearing at that time were kind of the epitome of womanhood. So tell us a little bit about how those women might have navigated the world so that they could impede reproduction and avoid pregnancy.
Certainly. What we have to do is step back and think about how could you even understand that you might not want to have children if that is the one and only option presented to you. So it's difficult to get back in that mental space if you don't know, or you don't even think of not having children as a legitimate option. So there are records of women who were very upset when they found out that they were pregnant. We know that not everyone wanted to be pregnant, but that isn't necessarily a fair representation of how, just because women accepted being pregnant because they didn't have any other visible societal options, doesn't mean that they necessarily were happy to be pregnant.
Or to be pregnant in quick succession
yes,
all the time,
yes.
right? You know,
for
even
years,
if they wanted kids, maybe they wanted a couple, yeah. but not every
not
other
that
year.
Many.
Yeah.
Yeah. but this was an era where contraception was hard to come by. And it wasn't because the technology didn't necessarily exist. So by the early 1900s, you could order contraceptive devices from catalogs, etc. But there, in 1875, Anthony Comstock was notable in passing his namesake law, the Comstock Act, that forbade the sale or manufacture or distribution of contraceptive devices. And so it really differed who you knew and what you knew. So if you were fortunate enough to have a female relative that was familiar with the female biology and could help you understand how best to prevent pregnancy, if there were some sort of device that you could use. A lot of what women used was douching, believe it or not. That was a common method of the time, and they would wash with some really horrific concoctions that were painful and certainly not necessarily effective, but that was one of the most common methods that they used. There were also some barrier methods available. Condoms were becoming more available, but at that time there was such a social stigma around it. So you were thought of as being a sort of a quote-unquote bad woman if you used contraception. So as we think about people's lives and choices then, not only was not having children not considered a very viable option, but also using contraception sort of put a layer of shame and blame on you. And so once again, it's hard to evaluate people's choices in that time, given that context.
I love it. It's sort of like this idea that if you're having children, no one really thinks about the fact that you're having had to have sex to get it or
yeah.
that you enjoyed it. But if you're using contraception, clearly you're having sex now. And that's the problem. I mean,
yeah.
it's such a,
right.
yeah, it's
yeah.
fascinating.
So, and you touch on this in the book too. You talk a lot about this in the book that, you know, of course, in the 19th and 20th centuries, women did not have pregnancy tests.
Correct.
And so they relied on the knowledge of their own bodies, of their own systems, calculating when they had their last period to determine if they were pregnant. And, you know, which didn't always work. That wasn't a solid Correct. System, of course. But so most women lived in this state of perpetual pregnancy or this perpetual possibility of being pregnant.
So it's the PPP,
yeah.
Potentially possibly yeah. pregnant.
I can't believe I said that clearly. That's a tongue twister.
Well done.
I know. And, you know, for us living today, we can hardly even imagine this.
Yes.
This kind of this, you know, possibility of being pregnant all the time. So can you tell us more about this, Jennifer?
Yeah, well, I can certainly try. It's not a mental space I can get into yeah, that easily yeah. because that's one of the challenges. You know, once we have information available to us, it's hard to imagine not having that information. And, you know, once again, given when we're thinking especially about rural women who were in this really intense physical regime, a lot of them wouldn't have regular periods. So they wouldn't have that to call back on to even calculate from in terms of counting when they might be delivering. And then, you know, if they weren't having regular periods, then, you know, you could be 3 or 4 months along sometimes before you finally started noticing physical changes that made you think, oh, wow, I think I might be pregnant. And all along in between conception and 3 to 4 months in, you really don't have any knowledge of whether you are or aren't. So it changed. You know, now there's such a clear, definitive, you know, I'm pregnant. You make the announcement, that whole kind of thing. And then the rest of the time, we get to think of ourselves as not pregnant.
Right.
And that was a mental space they couldn't go to. They did not have any way of knowing for sure they weren't pregnant. So you were in this potential reproductive landscape for your adult life. You were just there. There was no way to remove yourself from it, except for those women who were consistently infertile. But even sometimes, then there'd be a surprise. But for almost all women who were partnered, they simply, from the time that they were sexually active all the way through menopause, they would never really know. They would always just assume, well, I could be pregnant, you know, I'll just have to wait and see. So it's a mental space that is so very, very different from the not pregnant place that we all inhabit most of the time.
And psychologically, you know, I know that when I knew I was pregnant, I thought about things completely different than when I know I'm not pregnant.
That's so
and
true.
So I don't know if that was similar at that time or if they had a different mindset about the whole thing.
Well, people treat you differently when they know you're pregnant too. You're right. Even if once you announce it or make it public, that's such an interesting thing to think about. Huge difference.
Yeah.
The other thing that often sort of made me imagine sort of trying to think back to the 1860s, 1870s, before Montana was a state and things, there were no birth certificates, right?
Correct.
So babies are born, you know, hopefully they live, hopefully the mother lives, but we don't have these records, these certificates of when and where and exactly who the parents are. But as we see, we move into statehood and this becomes more common practice to record who these citizens are, who they're going to be, so we can understand this landscape, this statehood, nationhood that we're creating. Along with that, we have this rise of physicians and them moving into taking over some aspects of the birthing process. And as part of that, you and others who have looked at this topic across the nation historically have talked about, you know, this decrediting and even demonization of midwives and midwifery and this blame. And we know, though, early practices of physicians, they hadn't the experience, they didn't know a lot about women's bodies. I don't know, there's awful pictures where they're sneaking their head under a woman's skirt. It just looks horrific to me. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, for this region that you cover, the women that practice midwifery and the women who used midwives, what happened during that transition and you know, how that feeds into sort of the change from what we had really before this tracking and sort of numericalizing, which is not a word, but I'm going to use it, of births and all of that around birth and reproduction.
So as we look at this transition, there's a couple important specifics to note. So if we're thinking about birthing at home with a midwife, then there's the transition to birthing at home with a physician. Then there's the transition to birthing in the hospital with a physician. And all of those changes were sort of jumbled and happening sort of sequentially in different places, even in neighboring communities at different times, given availability. And one of the things that happened in there was the development of maternity homes, which I'll just make a quick mention of, because once women had been convinced not to birth at home with a midwife, they needed that postpartum care to recuperate. But in some communities, they hadn't yet built hospitals. So maternity homes were provided by some of these women who were previously providing midwifery care, but then had been pushed out. Running a maternity home was a way for them to still earn a living.
Talk about how they were pushed out. Why couldn't they continue to practice?
Well, this has been well documented across the country. This was with the Organization of Medicine. There was what was termed the midwife problem. And the midwife problem was that midwives had more business because women felt more comfortable with them. They had a lot more experience and expertise. And that they also, midwives charged less than physicians did. And so the midwife problem, this was a physician coined term, was that physicians wanted to get into the business of birth and midwives had a corner on the market, gotcha. So to speak. So yep. That was the midwife problem. And so what was initiated was a massive public relations campaign to make it un-American to have a midwife, especially a midwife that came from your home country that might speak the same language as you, and instead to prove your Americanness to hire a male physician. Mm-hmm. And so this was a process. This was, you know, we see it in Montana newspapers, we see it in medical journals, and there's, you know, a lot of scholars that have documented and demonstrated this over the years in terms of how widespread this was. So it was very much on the part of organized medicine. It was not as if every physician was wandering around saying nasty things about the local midwife. It was something that was done systemically nationwide.
So culturally, was it illegal to practice midwifery, or it was just this cultural push to really...
So it was not illegal by any means. It was simply made to be culturally bad, that you could have a
contraception, midwifery, it's all bad.
Yeah, you got it. So it was not illegal. What happened was that with the development of public health institutions, they started working more with physicians. They started putting more requirements on registering, and you'd have to go to a physician to fill out the birth certificate that eventually they would disallow. In some communities, they disallow the midwife from signing the birth certificate. So it wasn't as if it was illegal to have a midwife help you. It's just that there was a lot of extra work that you had to do to comply with state health department regulations. And most of it was the sense that, don't you want the best birth? Don't you want to prove that you're American? Why would you speak your old country language when having a new American baby? Why not go to the hospital and have a male physician deliver it to prove your Americanness? And so it was very much a cultural force that rapidly changed a birthing situation, not so much a legal force.
But not having a midwife sign a birth certificate once those do come in, you know, not having that is sort of removes them from the process, even when they still were attending or practicing.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. So as those midwives, you know, as their practices diminished, what we see is a number of them working, like opening their homes as maternity homes to provide that postpartum care so they could still earn some money. They would still potentially deliver babies or assist at deliveries for women who were of more marginalized groups, either had less money, though they couldn't afford a physician, etc. But then they would just kind of, by the process of attrition, they did other things.
Yeah. Right.
And
it just went away.
Exactly. And you also don't have young women coming into the profession because it's very clear that it's not something that's culturally supported.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that particular cultural knowledge and that habit of a social birth really changed.
It just goes away.
It goes
and that's
away.
Why I had never seen a birth before.
Exactly. You and me. Yeah, I know. Exactly. Oh, wow.
So you know, the culture changes.
Yes.
And that's, of course, what you write a lot about in this book is culture. And so kind of moving in that direction. And it, towards the end of the book, you say, quote, human culture is made tangible in reproduction. When we conceive of an idea, when we give birth to a dream, we mirror the process of creating new human beings. As a family or community welcomes an infant, members narrate identity, tell stories, and enact rituals. End quote. And so, and then another piece of this is what we've kind of been moving around this whole conversation is community. And I just want to read another quote that you have in the book that really speaks to this that Nancy pointed out. So, quote, reproductive activities made the Northern Plains and Rocky Mountains region a place to be from and a place to come home to. Women and mothers made citizens through tenderness and relationship. Theirs was an ecology of care connected to the land, the people, and the larger community. So that really gets to the heart of what you talk about in this book. So can you talk a little bit about this cultural and the cultural aspects of childbirth and why it's important to communities? And then follow up, why is this history important to us today? What can we glean from this and move forward with?
There's so much there. I will I will restrain myself to not take half an hour to answer that question. But if you think about it, we understand ourselves through the stories that we tell. And if we never tell those stories out loud, we never really understand ourselves. And the more we tell the stories, the more we hear that, the deeper that understanding comes. And so every time there's another child, those stories have to be retold. And so reproduction is the process by which, in telling that child who they are and who they belong to, that all the rest of us come to be reminded of it all over again. And so those stories are always evolving, but they're also the very thing that help us understand who we are and what matters to us. And so reproduction, therefore, lies at the very heart of meaning. It tells us who we are. And so as we think about, well, why does this stuff even matter? You know, if someone had a baby in 1890, what in the world does that have to do with us now? And there's a long list of things that we could extrapolate from that. But first of all, it would be the importance of caring, that these kinds of relationships centered around reproduction, they mattered. They mattered to people's lives. And they're important, and they still matter. These are things that, you know, when you talk to people about what they care about, why their life has meaning, it's usually based on their caring relational connections. And so much of what we do in modern contemporary American culture denigrates those connections. We certainly don't put a lot of monetary value on them. There's not a lot of support for those. And that's really at the heart of human experience. So we can learn something from a woman of 1890 by simply understanding that the things that matter to her largely still matter to us. And we can spend time and attention supporting those things. And there's, you know, there's a host of other lessons. The fact that if we were to listen to stories from the past, that a lot of stories that have gone unheard and unnoticed can be recorded, and that we can understand all these different perspectives, some of which actually help us understand a different region and a different culture in a really new way, that the American West was not about extraction and exploitation only, but instead had a lot to do with connection and exchange and support and caregiving.
I remember being in a course where talking about how so much of history, traditional histories, have been very focused on men, you know, sometimes one man, but often with men, or the things that can be documented about men's work, men's labor, men's activities. Yes. And so you very clearly point out, you know, that this is a little bit harder to get documentation. Mm-hmm. But first of all, we know it's happened because birth has happened here and all of that has happened. But also you have been able to find documents and fill in and piece together and weave a picture for us from those different threads and those narratives, mm-hmm. something that we can understand. I remember a lot of us responding in that course saying, you know, we are actually a little bit more than half the population as women. And to not actively search out and include that in understanding our past, who we are now, we really don't have a picture mm-hmm. at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more than half the people on the planet. It's more than half the labor and activity. Women aren't sitting around just consuming bonbons on a couch. You know, we are doing all of those things.
Which would be fun.
I know. We aspire to do that. But we, you know, looking at the way that you document this so important labor that nourishes and sustains, but just that sense of how a community is created by the way actually people are figuring out how to reproduce in that mm-hmm. region. That's what creates that regional culture. And I have never really tied that so closely, even as an anthropologist, into thinking about how culture is reproduced and why just in different regions it's varying. It's sort of who is that network of people who are there to help birth and sustain. So it's that reproduction in all senses of the word, both cultural and biological. So I think you've injected a really wonderful new angle onto understanding the settlement of this region. I hope that people take the same approach to other regions so that we mm-hmm. have a better understanding. It's certainly, as a woman who's raised my children here, mm-hmm. though I didn't birth them here, made me glad I had the choices I did. But God, such respect for what women were able to achieve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the questions I have about Native communities and birthing, I just think that's another whole book someone will hopefully write. There's a lot there. So absolutely. Thanks for this, Jennifer.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
my pleasure.
Well, we have so much more, of course, we'd love to keep asking you about, but we have run out of time for our podcast. So thank you so much for coming today, discussing the book, answering all our questions. And we encourage all of our listeners out there to please go out, find a copy, purchase a copy. You can get signed copies here at the Extreme History Headquarters. You can find some at the Museum of the Rockies, at the Country Bookshelf on Main Street, and of course on Amazon. So please, everyone, look for a copy of Birthing the West. And Jennifer, again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Anytime.
And Jennifer, what is the website for the Women's Reproductive History Alliance if people are interested in checking that out as well?
Wonderful. It is womensreproductivehistoryalliance.org.
Perfect.
If you can spell all of those words, you can find it.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and thanks to all our listeners out there for joining us today. If you love this podcast, please tell a friend and make sure to subscribe so it shows up in your podcast feed each week. And if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, that would be wonderful. Thanks for listening today, and we hope you can join us again to find out more about
the dirt on the past. If you would like to support The Dirt on the Past, consider throwing a few dollars our way via our Patreon page. Just go to Patreon and search for The Dirt on the Past. We would appreciate your support. A big thank you to our editor and sound guru, Steve Durbin. Thanks to Lawson Alegria for mixing the music, and to John Chadwell for help getting this podcast out in the world.